cost. But that's of the greatest value. And we'll get back to that in a minute. Let's jump back to Muhammad. We've left him in a cave. And you look and you see somebody who's absolutely terrified of these angels pursuing him. And he realizes that not everybody can come to the light at the same speed. That maybe we need to help each other out. That maybe there's a way that we serve each other by the way in which we live with each other. That maybe let's add Muhammad's contribution to this extraordinary chemistry of all these great masters. That maybe we have to recognize that other people's way will be very threatening to us and we to them. That maybe our becoming strong in life is not necessarily going to be embraced by other people. And that's absolutely true. Now I'm going to take you down from way up here in the heavens with the masters, and I'm going to drop you back on earth. And I want you to picture yourselves sitting in a classroom with me, and that I'm pulling down a screen against the wall. And I'm going to say, all right, this is you, and I want to show you something. I want to show you what a template looks like inside of you. Because one of the values, one of the many, many, many rich values that come from studying lives of the masters is that they represent what's in you, but it's not animated yet. And this is a very, very important thing to understand. You're working according to an unconscious program. It's an archetypal program. We're going to go so deeply into archetypes as we continue. But for now, let me say that you have a program in you, and their lives illustrate that program. It's a template. And so this is the one that's in you that was in them. This is why you look at a master, you look at any spiritual master, and there's something about them that just makes you feel so empowered and so full of hope. They make you feel full of hope. They make you feel loving. They fill your heart. They fill your spirit. What is it about them that does that? It's not their personalities. It's that their spirit does not lack one fragment. They've pulled together all their fragments. They are one. They are whole. They are that which we are trying. Let me say this again. They are that which we are destined. Let me say this again. They are that which we are programmed to become. Now, what's the template look like? Let me describe the pattern, because what they did is happening to you, right? Just as they were born, we're going to have to trust this at a particular time, place, and space. There wasn't just any accident, like let's drop a spiritual master into the middle of nowhere. This is timed. Similarly, your life is timed. It's not an accident. It's so well timed that it's timed. Now, once you are incarnated, just like the masters, look at these four, look at any. Each one went through a process of awakening. They didn't just know who they were. They didn't just know why they were here. They had their own questions about what specifically? The logic, the order, the purpose of life, and where they fit in to the whole scheme of life. They weren't born knowing that. Do you understand? They had to go on a mission and discover that. Here's the word, mission. They had to go on a journey. They had to wander through the desert. Buddha wandered. Jesus wandered. Muhammad wandered. Abraham wandered. They all did. They just didn't sit back and say, I want to know why I'm here, who I am, and what I'm supposed to do. Come on, let's go. It doesn't work like that. They discovered. And on the way to discovery, they realized that even the way to discovery was purpose. You're under contract to wander. Get used to it. That is as much a part of your contract as is perhaps your ability to heal somebody or to participate in that, or as is your ability to become somebody who nurtures people by the way you prepare your meals in a kitchen, to nurture and send light through food. Do you understand? You don't even realize what you're doing. All you need to do is to accept what you do very well and do it. And to accept what you don't do very well and realize, I'm not animated. There's no electricity with this. This isn't for me. I need to walk away. Back to the template that's in you. You are programmed. Your life includes the wandering journey. Just once? No. You're going to wander several times. You're going to wander every time you finish a stage of empowerment. You're going to be set off wandering again. Because part of what life is, part of the rules, are you can't sit still. You can't stand still. You can't be still until you are still. Oh, how confusing. It's not that confusing. Let me keep going here. It's so much fun because once you kind of get the rules, it's all right. I mean, you kind of get the rules and you realize we're all playing with the same rules, and that's why we're in this together. Okay. So now you're off wandering around. What's the next phase of your template? The next phase is that when the awakening comes in you, when you finally say, wait a minute, I wonder what the real purpose of life is. What happens when you ask that question? Because I have to assume that everybody who is listening to this program has asked that question, or is at least afraid to ask that question, and it's too late if you're listening because you've already asked that question. So what happens is, and listen clearly, at the moment that Jesus and Muhammad, Buddha and Abraham decided to follow the voice, to follow their interior, in that instant, they went through a reversal. A reversal. They went from living life in which matter was more important than their inner world to recognizing the inner world is more important than the external world. Now, let me say that again because it's so incredible that I can hardly stand my body when I teach this. In that moment, and this is called transformation, this is transformation. This is it, where you reverse yourself. You go from living a life in which you see the outside world coming toward you, and then you realize, wait, your inside world comes first, and it shapes and it forms the outside world. Well, what's so big about knowing that? I'll tell you what's so big about knowing that. It's great, big, huge. It's so big. Everything in your life is different when that finally drops into your being. You are being downloaded with the largest epiphany. Because from that point on, look, listen, feel this. Just feel this. I want you to put something in front of you that really has your power. Think about something. Think about someone, something, some unforgiving thing. Everyone listening has something in their childhood that they're still wimping about or crying, or some wound that you have yet to kind of sew up. Just get there. And now I want you to just hurt. I want you to just turn up the steam on that wound. Just turn up the fire. I want you to picture that person looking at you and saying, I don't care if I hurt you. You're nothing to me. I want you, if you're afraid, if someone's abandoned you, I want you to feel you are as alone as the day is long. I want you to be in the deepest part of your fear. And now imagine that I walk up to you and I whisper in your ear, listen to me. There's no truth to what you are looking at all. Watch this. And I'm going to tell you, take a really deep breath. Take such a deep breath. And in that breath, I want you to just pull that fear into you. And now look just for a tiny little, look at that shadow, that illusion that you're looking at, and realize, you know what? I gave that person authority over me. What was wrong with me? How could I have given that one person the power to control the whole of my life. I'm the one who determines who has power and authority over me. Nobody was born to control me. I give that away if I want to. Now that is an extraordinary thing. But you have to learn that. There comes a moment when we learn that. And let's go back to the masters. Part of their lives, if you look at it, part of their lives is that they learned that. And they had that moment where they finally realized power comes from within. And then, here we go, one last step, as if that wasn't enough. That's the step at which they chose. This is the choice step at which they decided to say, aha, I'll follow you. Abram went to Abraham and said, okay, I choose. I will go to Israel. And Jesus said, okay, I'll choose. I'll choose. I will choose to serve in this way. I will choose to die in this horrible way. I don't know why. I agree. Let's go. I choose to agree. And Buddha said, I choose. I choose to wander. I'm giving up all that stuff. There is something else. Everyone, Muhammad said finally to the angels, all right, all right, all right. I'll choose to follow this voice. I'll meet Allah. All of them make the choice. What happens when you make the choice? The next thing that happens is you develop a very different relationship to every one of the experiences you have in life. This is when your sight gets elevated and you start thinking in terms of contracts. Before this point, everything looks like it's casual, it's awful, it can hurt, it's this. We think in terms of luck. You got bad luck, you got good luck, you've got no luck. Everything looks like accidents, this kind of thing. Now I'm going to yank you up by the shoulders. I'm going to, and I'm going to sit you down. And now you're at the level where you look at life and you realize, oh my, it's not an accident. I've made agreements. I have to rethink about every single relationship in my life. I have to rethink about why I can't have a relationship with this person. No matter what I've done, nothing seems to engage contact. Maybe I don't have a contract with that person. And this one, this person. And it just fell together, and our friendship feels like it's 35,000 years old. Maybe we did agree to be together for some reason in this lifetime. Maybe there is some purpose. Maybe that purpose is just to love each other and be each other's best friend. Maybe we agreed to be on the journey together because we have what it takes to support each other, and we all need that. You do have contracts like that, and that's the purpose of them. To be a support to somebody's heart. Not all your contracts are to build great businesses or to do great jobs. Sometimes a contract you have with someone is to be a loving support to them. And what greater contract can you have? You would know it if you need that in your life. If the moment ever comes when you think, God, I need to be loved right now. I feel so alone. What would you rather find out? That you have a contract to go start yet another business? Or what do you need in that moment is someone for your spirit. Very interesting how you value contracts in the moment. But let's go back now where we left off with the masters and where that template is in you. And at that level, you have choice. And what are you really choosing? But to see life very differently from now on like them. You're going to decide to see that you have choice, but you don't get answers, because that's part of the template. Why don't you get answers? Here's part two. What did they all do that you have to do? They surrendered. Every one of them. Every one of them said, I don't know why you want this. I don't know. I don't know why life is the way it is. I don't know any of that stuff. All I know is there must be a source of wisdom, reason, love, compassion that is far greater than me. It does not owe me an explanation as to why things are what they are, as they are, where they are, why they are. All I know is that my task is to incarnate, to learn how to use my spirit. How to maximize the use of this force that is my spirit. I see from their lives that my spirit has the ability to become a vessel for healing, for service, for light, for shadow, for everything. And that if I look at the choices they made, and I take that template of what is wisdom, what is love, what is compassion, what is not, and apply that to every circumstance, situation, event, relationship I'm going to have in my life, the result will be that all my fragments will come back to me as their fragments came back to them. And that I will accomplish some stage of enlightenment because a fragment is light. And I take more of my light into my system and I grow in enlightenment. This is what that means. In every one of the situations, circumstances, challenges, beautiful, all my talents, all my opportunities, all my everything, every one of these is a contract that serves the whole of my enlightenment, all of it. In this, you are the same as me. I am the same as you. All right. Now that it brought you back to get down to the nitty-gritty day-to-day, what is a contract anyway in my practical life? Long before I'm a master, I want to know what to do with it here on earth. I'm going to give you a tool as your beginning point, and that's called animation. And I talk about that as the word that represents the electrical, the energetic connection that we have in life, that I think your spirit is a source of animation. It is animated. It's a life force. You know, if you look back and read the book of Genesis, for example, there is the scene where God takes the dirt from the earth, takes the earth, and he breathes life into it, uses the breath to animate earth, and from that life comes. Now, that is animation. Your whole breath is animation. Now, that's your trigger point, a sensing device as to what, who, where you have a contract. You can feel something. Now, you know, I have spent a long time teaching people about the nature of intuition. But what intuition is, truly, is your ability to sense animation. That's what it is. And someone like me, I sense your animation at a distance. That's all I do. But anybody can do that. The only difference between me and someone else is that I know it, and most people don't believe it. But it's as simple as anything, and you are always sensing the animation of other people. You're always sensing, for example, the animation of people you have a contract with, whether or not you realize it. It's just that you are not recognizing that energy that you're sensing is that. So let me ask you about something just to think about as I talk about animation. And that's, when you meet somebody, you can sense right away whether or not you're animated with them. If you like them, dislike them, this or that, you know it right away. Now, that's a signal that you have a contract. You also know when you have no animation at all, don't you? You know exactly what that feels like. It's like flat soda. It's like nothing. It's like nothing. You don't remember them. It's not that they're unimportant. Hear what I'm saying. It's just that they're not energetically connected to you. So it'll be very hard for you to remember them, or it might be very hard for you to get any specific fix on them. That energy is not there. Whereas, when you do have that energy with someone, you can only be with them for a second and you remember it. And in fact, sometimes it won't ever leave you. Can you think of someone in your life where you just met them for a few minutes and they have stuck with you? And you hope that you'll see them again? That's what I'm talking about. One person I know said that she met a gentleman that she wanted to get involved with in a personal relationship. And she felt what I would call animation. Of course, you can call it whatever you want. But I mean, she said she was very animated toward this person, kind of thing. And she wanted a long-term relationship with this person. Now, that's not how it unfolded. They did have a long-term relationship, but it didn't unfold in a romantic way. It came in a different way in that they started to work together. She, of course, always held in her mind that it would shift to a different kind of role, but it never made it into that direction. He felt a connection to her, but he felt it in a different way. And when they put their chemistries together, they had what it took. They were scientists. They still are. They do great work together. They're phenomenal with the chemistries of their two brains and their insights and their intuition. You put them together and they seem to compensate for what the other one doesn't have. One is a very sharp strategist. The other one has a fantastic gut response, intuitive. For the record, the man's the intuitive. And she's the strategist. She's this brilliant mind. She wanted it to be something it wasn't contracted to be. So the animation didn't go there, but when you put them in the laboratory together, this is where they were meant to be. This is where they agreed to be. This is where they agreed to find each other. And that's where they agreed to have a path of service in life. How does this other factor play in? I'm going to walk you through this because it's important to know that. I'm going to call this person, just call her the letter A. Let's say that A really did not feel good about herself and needed this person to make her feel good about herself. She felt great about herself as a scientist. She knew she was brilliant. But she didn't feel good, perhaps, in the partnership way. Whereas she wanted this man to fill in that space. This man couldn't do this. Now, here's where the important part comes in, and I want you to follow this carefully. I want you to imagine that he had a unit of her spirit in his backpack. And what he had in his backpack was a unit of her spirit that she had to not need from him so that he could finally give it back to her. Let me say it this way, because that could sound confusing until you get it, all right? Did you ever say, now that I don't need it, you can have it? You know that expression? Mm-hmm. She wanted him to approve of her so that she wouldn't have to approve of herself. If he could give her that approval, then she would be okay. He had a contract with her that read, never give her approval, because if you do, she'll never develop her own. So his role was never to approve of her. Isn't that outrageous? But that was the contract. I'm not supposed to approve of you. Otherwise, you will never become strong enough, listen to this, not to need me. And you must become strong enough not to need me, because then we can be together as equals. So, here's how it played out. They were very bonded as scientists. They had great respect. And in that role, because they were equal, because they empowered each other equally, neither of them went through those insecurities of thinking, what if he left me? What if she left me? It was a completely different relationship. But in this other world, she wanted something from him, and he was under contract not to give it to her. So there was this tight kind of lack of emotional animation that was not coming back. He could not do that. And then one day, she was able to say to herself and realize, I cannot reach to this person for something that I should generate within myself. And from that point on, she was able to accept the relationship as it was scripted, as two scientists. She had empowered herself. And you see how she became more whole from that. There was no animation romantically. She had to become strong enough to recognize that. It was a fantastic story. A fantastic story. This is how contracts play out on the earth, these small, individual, tiny ways. But I haven't even begun to go near, what does it look like to wake up to your talent? Do you know how many people are sent into your life to wake up your talent, to make you come alive to all the empowerment you have? You haven't got a clue. There are so many people that come in your life to protect you so that some harm doesn't come to you. An extraordinary amount of interesting roles and contracts you have. And then there are the ones you have. Don't forget what you're doing in other people's lives. The point is, what I want you to learn is this: how to recognize animation, and then how to interpret it. How to interpret your contracts, how to recognize, how to know what to do with them, and how to interpret them. And we begin that by entering through the archetypal world, which comes next.
This concludes Session 2 of Sacred Contracts with Carolyn Mace. Our program continues with Session 3. Sounds True presents Sacred Contracts, Session 3, Archetypes, Your Energetic Companions, with Carolyn Mace.
And now we're going to jump into the realm of archetypes. I want to set the space. I want to set your inner space. I want you to run upstairs again with me. You are on the mystical plane. You haven't incarnated yet. You're packed in your backpack with your contract. You're about to descend. But I can't let you go just right yet. Not completely on your own. Because you have to have a team. You have to have a team of guardians. I can't let you go immediately on your own. This is where I take you to the archetypal realm. So I'm going to take you by your hand, and we're going to go down one level. And here we are in a realm that exists between what we could think of as divine eternity and the human unconscious. Here is this space. It's almost like the psychic ozone or the unconscious ozone. And in it are patterns, universal patterns of consciousness that we all, every one of us, recognize. And that's an archetype. Let me give you a feel for one. If I said to you, that person is such a bully, do I have to describe bully to you? All of you would more or less define it the same way. Or if I said, that woman is such a nurturing mother. And then if I said to you, define nurturing mother, all of you would at least come up with three words that were identical in your definition. Now, this is so intriguing. I want to push you into this more because it's absolutely fascinating. An archetype is more than a definition or a pattern. It's kind of an interesting discussion. Is it a being? Is it an angel? Is it what exactly is it? So I'm going to give you a sort of half being, half angel, half pattern. How many halves can I have? Equation. Well, thirds. Let's divide it into thirds, okay? Colleagues of mine would suggest that an archetype is a neutral pattern, just a thought form, but it's larger than an ordinary mortal thought form. It's a grand thought form that we all recognize, a kind of a mothership, and that it beams identical waves into every one of us that has that same pattern. I think there's a lot of truth to that. By being neutral, it means that an archetype is neither a positive nor is it a negative force. It simply is a pattern. Okay? Some other of my colleagues, and I'm talking about people who are professionally trained, like Jungian analysts, whose field is archetypal studies, would suggest that archetypes are actually beings and should be considered beings. And I think, well, in a sense, I could accept that too. Now, I want you to follow this because it's so exciting. If you and I, if all of us shared the same archetype, which we do, we all have a child archetype. Now I want you to imagine that there's a grand ship called the child archetype. So all of us are doing two things simultaneously. We're sending feedback to this huge child archetype about how our personal child is evolving. We're checking in. Okay, this is not unlike the image I gave you earlier, which is to be a server in the computer system, in the email, where the child could be the server, and each of us has a computer. We're all working from the same program. That program is called the child program. This is better. So every day I type in how my child experience the day, and if my child got angry, and if my child was happy, and if my child was abandoned, and if my child this, and what my child learned today, and what my child is struggling with, and then I hit the send button. So that sends up to the server called child. Now all of us are doing that simultaneously through this. The grand child archetype evolves. This is how evolution occurs, because all of us feed our own individual patterns into this larger one, and the larger one continues to shape and reshape itself according to what we're doing. Does that make sense to you? Okay. In this way, you could say, well, is an archetype real? Is it a being? In a sense, it is alive. In a sense, it's mechanical. In a sense, it's intimate. In a sense, it's completely impersonal. It's all of these things. But the one thing you can count on is that it's real. It's a genuine, genuine force. The first thing you do when you meet somebody is you sense their archetypes, believe it or not, long before your eyes focus on their body and face and your ears attune themselves to their voice. Long before that, your animation frequency, that part of your energy, has already reviewed their energetic system, and you've already picked up their archetypes. You've already sensed them. Listen to everybody from now on. I want your ear to tune up. Listen to the way you describe people. Listen to how often you said, that person just reminds me of a fill in the blank. What do you think you're talking about? You've just picked up an archetypal pattern. You could say, that woman is just such a princess. You're picking up a pattern. You're picking up an archetypal pattern. As I talk to you about these, what I'm talking to you about is material you've always known. You've known and you've always known. You've grown up knowing. It's been in your instincts. It's been in your field of sensory systems. You've always been able to sense this. What you've perhaps never known is how far back and how intimate your connection to archetypes is, what role they really serve, and how to consciously engage with them. So, up we go. Come back up with me. Whoosh. We're in that place where I'm going to walk you down and I'm going to say, now then, you have this distinct contract in your life and a lot of small ones that are going to make up the whole. You need a team to help manage that. You need archetypal guardians that will script, hold, maintain, and refine your consciousness to the maximum, that helps you see reality, interpret reality, approach reality in a way that suits your life's work. Okay, having said that, let me take that definition down to an even more grounded way. So we look at archetypes, and you think, in this lifetime, I really need to do a lot for people in the area of helping them heal from wounds. That's my role. So I would say to you, well, then you know what? You need to have the wounded healer archetype. You need that one. So I would go to the wounded healer file. I'd open it up, and I'd take a stencil. You know what a cookie stencil is? I take a stencil. Why am I using that image? I chose that very consciously because a stencil is a specific pattern. This stencil, say it looks like a gingerbread man to give you a visual. All right, now it's an empty stencil of a gingerbread man. I have a million of them and they're all identical. But how you fill each one is going to be up to you. So this is where you share the identical stencil, the same parameters, the same boundaries, the same everything. But how you fill it is going to be up to you. So I give you your wounded healer stencil, and I say, come on, let's go figure out the next realm. So then we keep talking, and we decide that, you know what, another archetype that would be really beautiful on your life's mission would be the artist. The artist works very well for you because you have so much artistic talent. And you think, that's good. Yeah, that's going to work. So we give you the artist. And then we start filling out. How many do you get? Well, first, how many archetypes are there? There are an endless array of archetypes. In fact, this is kind of an overwhelming thought, but the whole of life is an archetypal experience. Everything in life can be seen, approached, understood, worked with, dealt with, symbolically, and that's what it means to see it archetypally. Everything has its symbolic purpose, its symbolic angle. And when you decide to see something symbolically, you convert it from its physical form to its highest level of purpose. At that point, you're seeing it archetypally. So, from that point of view, we could say that the entire world is an archetypal journey, which it is. All of life. Then, when you say, well, how many archetypes are there? They're endless, and they keep reproducing. Let me give you an example of some new archetypes that never existed before. One's the networker, and another one the computer geek. We never had those before, but watch. If I said, that person's a computer geek, would you imagine somebody with glasses on? Uh-huh. And would you imagine someone who looks like Cary Grant? I don't think so. Right? Alfred E. Newman? Absolutely. Mad Magazine? You would see somebody who does not have high voltage sexual libido if I said computer geek. Because in our minds, we've already decided these two things don't go together. We just don't think they go together. And then we have an archetype that emerged called the networker. What's a networker? How many people jump on their computers and do emails the moment after dinner? They get home, they have dinner, and boom, they're in the basement and they connect with that machine, and that's their companionship for the rest of the night. They date via email, they dance via email, they live down there, they get on those chat rooms. That's a networker. This is a real pattern. And you realize that emerged out of our culture, that is an archetype. And I can assure you that before you're born, you get this cluster of archetypes, and they are more intimate with you than all of the other patterns that are available in the human unconscious. Having said that, I want to add something here, and that's, I said earlier that the fundamental law of the universe is that what's in one is in the whole, what's in the whole is in one. This is law. And as such, I can say to you that all of the archetypes that exist, the whole of the archetypal realm, does exist within your unconscious. Yes, that's true. But are they all as prominent? No, they are not. This is where that sense of prominence, that sense of importance, plays itself out in terms of a match, a direct match, for what your life's work is. And it's so interesting. You know what it's like to look at someone and say, wow, I would love to have artistic talent like that person does. And you just don't. And no matter what, someone would say, why don't you just take a painting class, paint the walls, do anything. You hold that brush in your hand, it falls, it slips, you can't do squat. You are so not in that archetype, it's not funny. It's like, get away from there, don't even go near it, you have not got it. But if you have, let me show you how penetrating it is. There is such a thing as the starving artist archetype. Absolutely. And you know what it's like when somebody says, how many times have you heard someone say, you're the artist, you know you can't make any money till after you're dead. There is almost an assumption. Is you go shopping in an art gallery and you say, this is lovely, is the artist dead? Then I don't want it. I only buy art from dead artists. But it's true. I know somebody personally who has an enormously strong artist archetype. And this is a very good example to use, an incredibly strong artist archetype. And he chose, remember I was talking about choice and surrender. It was his choice to not pursue the artist archetype in a welcoming way. I'm going to explain this in great detail so you understand what I'm saying. It's very important. Rather than look at his own talent, his own artist, his own precious ability that he'd contracted for, his whole life would open up in such an exquisite way had he followed this artist. It doesn't mean it would be without challenge. It doesn't mean that it would be without effort, but it would be exquisite no matter which route, because he would discover that artist in him. He'd plunge deeper into his talent. But instead, he hooked in to the starving artist. And he absolutely hooked in to this belief. It paralyzed him. The belief was that if you went the way of art, you wouldn't be able to support your family, you'd never make any money, da da da. And he believed it. That archetype took hold of him. Do you understand? It just gripped him. And he had to find some other way of manifesting this artist. And he did. He manifested it in going the route of cosmetic surgery. So he brought his artistry into cosmetic surgical medicine, so to speak. But you know what? He's miserable. He's absolutely miserable. And this is important because, you see, he did use it. He did manifest it. It had to manifest. He had a contract to explore part of his life as the artist. But he chose the path of fear, and so it came through that way. It's absolutely intriguing. Now let's roll back for a minute. And the question obviously is, how many of these intimate companions do you have? And I'm telling you that you have 12. Well, where does that number come from? Did I just whimsically pull it out of my head? No. Like all other material that I offer people, it comes from years and years of seeing patterns duplicate themselves. When I first started to do readings and began to pick up archetypal patterns, I started to notice one or two, sort of three, maybe readings, something like that. But I didn't notice 12 because I was just learning how to pick up an archetypal pattern to start with. Oh, have I got stories about that? But anyway, I have to give you an example. This is just a fun story, but I did a reading on this woman, and to show you how strong an archetypal pattern is, she came in for an appointment with my colleague, Norm Shealy, the physician that I work with. And she came in because she had what's called a phantom pain in her neck, sometimes referred to as a phantom goiter. Norm couldn't find anything, and he'd put her through tests, and he's the brilliant doctor. If he can't find it, it doesn't exist. So he calls me up, and he says, Carolyn, I have this patient in my office, and let's just make up a name. Let's say the patient's name is Susan. And he says, Susan and her age is 30, and those are the two stats that I need, your name and your age. And I instantly got an impression of a woman in a pirate's outfit. Now, I have to emphasize something. At this point, I don't know much about archetypes, if any. So I'm thinking that this is really what she looks like. Okay? I'm not yet to the point where I'm reading symbology. So I see this woman, and she's got a long skirt on, and she's got a belt on, and she's got that sort of scarf around her neck, and she's got a sort of a sword on the back of her. And I'm in this imagery, and I snapped out of it, and I grabbed the phone, and I said, "Norm, why is she dressed like that?" And he's looking at your basic Southern Missouri housewife in the jeans and the top, right? And he says, "I don't know, maybe she likes it." I closed my eyes. I'm looking at a pirate. And I said, "Didn't your staff say something when she walked in?" Now, mind you, let me explain something. She can't hear me because I'm not on the speakerphone, all right? I said, "I don't understand why your staff didn't say anything." And he says, "Norm is very sort of direct. What are you looking at?" And I said, a pirate, Norm. What have you got in your office?" And he says, "A housewife. I'll call you later." Click. Well, so he and I talked about it. And I told him that I saw this woman and her head being chopped off with a sword. Now, what's fascinating here, because since this time, of course, since that time, your archetypal imageries tell me stories about you. And they try to tell you stories about yourself. So I'm going to get you into yourself as soon as I get you intrigued about what you can find out about yourself. So as we talked about it, I said in the imagery, her head was chopped off by the sword. Question, what does a pirate tell you? If I said, "All right, tell me about your associations with a pirate," what would you say? You'd say wild on the seas. You would say buccaneer, pirate, they mean the same thing. You might say there are thieves on water. You might say they live wild island lives and bury treasure, etc. Okay, now stay with me. What's a buried treasure? I want you to think about in yourself. You are a buried treasure. You. Your inner life is a buried treasure. Not out on the water. You start thinking, well, if I have the pirate imagery, I have what it takes to be completely wild, to race and be an incredibly wild person, because I don't want to look at my treasure. I'll bury it. Because if I looked at what a treasure I was, I might have to land and make different choices that show, reflect a higher evaluation of myself. But until then, I think I will bury this gold, because I'm not yet ready to value myself, because if I do, I have to make choices of a higher quality. Does that make sense to you? So we worked with that image, because this is what that woman was dealing with. She was encountering an archetype that had come close to her psyche that said, "This is why you're suffering. You don't want to make certain choices." Oh, well, look at her. The fifth chakra, the throat, the goiter. She was dealing with will and choice. So you know how Norm dealt with this? I think this is hilarious. He says to this conservative person, he suggests that they do some imagery, but what he really means is past life regression, but he's not going to tell her that. And he says, "Let me just sort of relax and give you some imagery." He says, "You're on the water and it's blue and it's beautiful. And it's sort of Caribbean and you've got warm breezes." And the next thing you know, she saw this ship being attacked, the buccaneers, like a pirate. And there she was. And you know what she saw? She saw her head lopped off by an axe. It was a duplicate image. It was a duplicate image. And could it mean that it literally happened? Who knows? Who cares? What's important is she saw, she recognized, she made contact with an archetypal force that completely embodied one of her life lessons, which was to choose, make choices that reflect and allow her own empowerment to come out. This is how an archetypal contract works its way out. This is how your archetypes work with you. Now, back to the question of where did I come up with 12? Well, the more readings I did, the more I started to make note that, in fact, people seemed to have more intimate connections, like the one I just described with Susan and the pirate. But I didn't see a martyr in her, whereas I saw a martyr in someone else. So you start making notes. And then with Susan, I saw other patterns, and with someone else, others. And pretty soon, it appeared that people would have kind of a complex of 12 very close archetypal patterns. And the rest were very distant. They weren't certainly as directly involved in the day-to-day construction of your life as other archetypes are. Now, all of you, I'm sure, can imagine if I said, do you know what a victim is? Can you feel a victim in yourself? Because a victim is something you have. We share 4 archetypes. Each person has a victim, a prostitute, a saboteur, and a child. Everybody has those 4. And I think of those archetypes as the 4 archetypes of survival. Where did that come from? Well, again, I'm going to turn you back to my laboratory and say that as I did research, and I'm talking years, maybe 10, 12 years of this, those 4 archetypes repeatedly have come up, and they represent collectively the challenges every one of us faces to see how well we ground ourselves and whether or not we fear or feel safe with this thing called life. Those 4 archetypes contain our own fear of survival, and we will face lessons. We will face challenges with each one of those archetypes. Now, I want you to hold that thought and quickly jump back. I'm going to bring you back to the Masters just for a little bit, just for a visit, and show you that even the Masters encountered the prostitute, saboteur, child, victim. Quickly, Jesus was the divine child, incarnated into the divine child archetype. When we think of that child, we think of the divine child, an extraordinary archetype that absolutely came in perfectly because that archetypal form gave birth to the template of what? Something that had never existed before, the Holy Family. Never existed before. All right, hold that one. Here comes the archetype that they really challenge, which is the archetype of the prostitute. Let's see how they dealt with that one. Abraham, how did he do with the prostitute? He didn't do very good. I'll show you what he did. You know, he got stuck in, he had to flee, and he took his wife, and they fled into Egypt. And Abraham was a wealthy man, and he had slaves, and he had property, and he had animals. He had all kinds of things. He was no poor person. This guy was a wealthy little cookie. So he goes on into Egypt, and he's a frightened man. He's also a coward. He's got one of those archetypes. And he gets in there, and the Pharaoh says, like, who are you, and what are you doing, and et cetera, et cetera. And he wants to cover his backside. So you know what he does? He says to his wife, look, I'm going to tell the Pharaoh you're my sister, and you go sleep with him, and I'll be safe. The prostitute. Now, what's rich? No, pay attention. Don't you see? Get excited about this. What's so rich is that what you realize as you come into your archetypal patterns is that there's nothing heaven can't embrace. How incredibly non-judgmental the gods are. No matter which way Abraham explored the prostitute, it was okay so long as he explored the prostitute. Because as I emphasize, to do something wrong is to learn how to do it right. You cannot not learn. It's impossible. So if you said to me, Carolyn, can I fail my contract? How can you fail? Failure doesn't exist. You can decide you didn't meet your own mark, but you cannot fail. You can only learn. Whether you learn this way or that way, you can only learn. Okay, so much for Abra. Of course, you know what happens. Eventually, there's all kinds of trouble in Egypt, and that's when the Pharaoh says, this isn't your sister, it's your wife, you creep, get out of here. And the Pharaoh decides that that's the reason why Egypt fell apart and had a famine. So anyway, so much for that. But look at Jesus. Let's go with Jesus. He's been initiated. Do you understand how exciting this is? He's been initiated. He's already gone through the high marks. He's a master. But now comes the test. And you listen carefully, because if you think you're not going to be tested again and again, I told you, I'll say it again, and I'll say it again. Every time, every single time, you can count on this. This is an archetypal pattern. You learn something about your own inner power. The first thing that happens, you'll do it even if I tell you you can't avoid it, because the archetype is stronger than you are. The first thing that'll happen is you'll feel in some way arrogant, or you'll feel in some way special, or you'll feel somehow or other that you've outwitted. Watch my words. You've outwitted the whimsical nature of God. You've outrun chance. Ugh, you fools. The next thing that happens is something comes out of the clear blue and tampers with your power and visits what? Your ego. So long before your new power becomes truly absorbed into your spirit, your ego is going to get a knock on the door, and this is what it looks like. We're back. We're back in Jerusalem. We're back in the desert. We're right outside Nazareth. We've left the Essene community. We've just gone through initiation. And now we're going to go into the desert. We have to fast for 40 days. How come, biblically, by the way, let me plant an archetypal question in your head. Why is everything 40 days, 40 nights? Floods, tests, think. There's a reason. There's a reason. I'll give you the answer later. I just want to make sure you keep listening. So, he has to be in the desert 40 days and 40 nights. He can't have water, can't have food. He has to go through a test of this. Now listen carefully. The test is, can you finally make your spirit stronger than your body? Can you make your inner world outrun the external world? Is your spirit strong enough to maintain life no matter what happens on the outside world? Or will you sell yourself when there's a challenge, when you're afraid, when you're weak, when you're hungry, when you're down? This is the prostitute. And the prostitute will come and test you, I'm telling you, again and again and again. The moment you become empowered, and as soon as something, even in the smallest part of your life, even in your family, even in anything, you get a raise at work, I promise you, some part of the tribe you work with, if they didn't get the raise, they'll try to negotiate some kind of power play with you. Because people don't celebrate your raise if they didn't get one. It's just not the way we work. So here comes the devil, here comes Satan. And Satan says to Jesus, I will give you every single material object on this earth if you give me that power your soul now has. I want that power, and I'll give you this power. Will you sell yourself for me? And he says, get behind me, Satan, beat it, get out of here. This looks like a test, and you think, oh, just God could do that. You don't understand. That's an archetypal test, and you have the prostitute, and I can say to you, because you have that archetype, be on the lookout. You're going to have this test. You're going to have it many times. Do you understand how rich it is to recognize that? Have you any idea if you know that? You could be in a financial crisis. Let me just reroute you for 1 second, whether it's a financial crisis or, let's say it's the opposite way. Let's say you've got barrels and gobs of money. You've got so much, it's coming out of your garage. It's here, it's there, it's falling off the roof. I know you're rolling your eyes back saying, please, God, give me that house. But anyway, let's just imagine that someone comes up to you and says,